Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 55 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, sometimes known as Schultzy. Hold it. I think you're going to like this picture. We've got a great guest today, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But first, let me say that it's now December. Time to start planning that holiday shopping. Don't go out for Black Friday, even though that was a couple of days ago. Don't go out to those crowded malls. Simply go to thecommentarytrack.com. Buy a copy of the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. I mean, this thing features Leonard Maltin and Kevin Brownlow and William Wellman Jr. and Maria Janice Cooper, the daughter of Gary Cooper. And it tells a great story about a bunch of kids who made a parody of Beaugest while Beaugest was still in theaters in 1939. And that Paramount came down on them like a fist. Oh, it's a great story. And it's a great documentary, if I do say so myself. And who else is going to say it if I don't? Jeez, I mean, come on. So, please go there and buy that, or go to the books page on my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and you'll see lots of books that I've written there. There's a couple that are really appropriate for the season. AMC's The Great Christmas Movies, which is a tie-in to a special I wrote and directed a few years ago. And also Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, a classic film, now 20 years old. It shocks me to my very core to say. But I wrote that making-of book, and you can click through Amazon and buy it, and then I'll get a few shekels back. Not many, but a few. But you can order Great Christmas Movies directly from me, or any of my other books that have prices. Here's the way you could tell. If it has a price, then I have it, and you can order it from me, and I'll autograph it if you want me to. If it doesn't have a price, it'll just have an Amazon link. So go to Amazon and buy it there. And then at least I'll get a little bit of a kickback, you know, a nickel or something. But those nickels add up. For instance, if only 600,000 of you bought books from me this month, that nickel apiece would be pretty good. I know that's possibly not going to happen, but I mean, come on, 500,000 of you, really? That's only logical. My guest today is not going to have any trouble selling his books this December, because he has written some that are not only really good books, very well written, deeply researched, but are just beautiful to look at. His newest book is called George Harrell's Hollywood, Glamour Portraits, 1925 to 1992, and it's his second book on the great photographer of the glamour age of Hollywood, and it's really something. It's about the size of a small car, but much more beautiful than a small car, I believe. The portraits printed in this thing look better than they've ever looked, and he'll talk a little bit about that and how that came to be. He knew Harrell and worked with him, and Harrell taught him some of his tricks, and now Mark works out of Harrell's old studio with Harrell's camera, and will take your portrait. So I'll leave all that information on the website afterwards and how to go to his website and look all that stuff up, but also look up many of his books. He's written books on Irving Thalberg, on Greta Garbo, on Jean Harlow. He wrote a great book called Sin and Soft Focus, Pre-Code Hollywood. Mark is really something, and I'm surprised that he and I have never met. For some reason, our paths have just never crossed. I've been an admirer of his for a long time, and so I was tickled and delighted to go up to the studio about a week ago and talk to him, and I hope that you'll find it as fascinating as I did. So here's my conversation with Mark Vieira, and I will see you on the other side.
Yeah, I was just finishing up my film studies at USC Cinemas. This would be May of 74, and I was just kind of frustrated because I wasn't getting to make the films I wanted to make, and I was invited to take a job at the School of Dentistry as a staff photographer, where I'd been working as an audiovisual department part-time work-study employee for the past year. So I was looking at these pictures that Harrell shot, both in magazines, you know, vintage magazines, and in stills that I'd be buying at Larry Edmonds Bookstore, Collector's Bookstore, places on Hollywood Boulevard. In those days, you can get those pictures like for, you know, $3. Sometimes you'd get 11 by 14 for, if they had them, you know, for 15, 20. But, you know, they were starting to get wise at that point, so they were up around 100. But I was just fascinated by his lighting, because I had been studying lighting as it applied to movies, and to see what he did, which seemed like breaking the rules, that he would, you know, have this hot light from above and light bouncing up into the subject's eyes, things you couldn't do on a movie set because, you know, the person had to move and you can't have this bounce light happening with cards and stuff in front of him. Anyhow, here we are, May of 74, and I knew a man at the MGM stills department. His name was Dory Freeman. And he'd been working there since the late 30s, both first in New York and then in Culver City, because he was the head of the Joan Crawford fan club. And she got him a job in, I think, 37, operating a mimeograph machine in New York at MGM's offices there. And then he came out to L.A. So he said, oh, I hire people like George Harrell, Eric Carpenter, all these veterans, to shoot stills on movie sets. So I have his phone number. So Dory Freeman gave me George Harrell's phone number, so I, you know, very nervously dialed him, and I said, hi, I'm a student at USC, which I still was at that point, and I'd like to, you know, see, you know, if we could talk, show you some, so I have some of your photos from the 30s and 40s, I'd like to, you know, ask you questions about your technique and show you my work. And he says, you know, I'm sorry, I'm really busy, I'm working long hours on movie sets, I don't have time to visit people, sorry, click. But then, about a year and a half later, he asked Dory Freeman if he could borrow stills from Dory's collection, because Dory Freeman had this collection of Joan Crawford memorabilia that was second to none. His home was like a shrine. But he had a huge amount of photographs from that period that he was supposed to have thrown away when he... I think he came from New York to L.A. in 44, 45. At that point, all these big stars from the 30s, whom Harrell had photographed 10 years earlier, Joan Crawford, Norma Shearer, Jean Harlow, Jeanette MacDonald, Myrna Loy, had all left or, you know, in Harlow's case, had died. But he was told to throw away all these key set prints. And these key set prints were what... A key set is the collection of photos... from one film, from number one through number 300 or whatever, you know, in the case of Marie Antoinette, 1 to 1,000. So you've got scenes from the movie, behind the scenes shots where they're filming, and you've got portraits. So they told him to throw all these away. These dames aren't here anymore. Just throw this crap out. Just throw it away. Put it in the dumpster or get it incinerated. Now, key set prints were handmade prints. They're, you know, gallery quality. Gorgeous, gorgeous things. And he... somehow or other didn't, you know, get caught taking them off the lot, all these prints. So we got all these yellow boxes, you know, Kodak film boxes or paper boxes full of these fantastic, fantastic prints. I mean, incredible stuff. So Harrell was doing a book, needed photos for his book because he didn't keep anything because he was working as for hire. He was, you know, was worked for hire for a studio, and he was not allowed to keep negatives or he could have prints, I guess, but he never thought it was important enough or he would need them. So here he was in 1975 doing a book, and he had to have pictures for the book, and he didn't have them. So he just turns to collectors, and they're not going to let the pictures out of their possession for a year because things were being lost or stolen. So Dory Freeman knew that I was doing copy work at USC, and he was very skilled using a certain kind of film called Kodak Pro Copy 4125 sheet film, and using a special developer, HC110 Dilution E. And boy, those copies really look good. So Dory proposed to George Harrell that he meet me at his home, at Dory's home, on South Almont Drive in West Hollywood. So I went there on a Saturday afternoon, and I brought some of my own work, my portraits that I've been shooting, and I brought samples of my copy work, and then Dory had brought out his boxes of stills, and Harrell went through them, and they chose things for me to shoot copy negatives of. So that's how I met George Harrell.
How soon did it take for you to start working with him?
Well, that's just it. People think that I was his protege or his employee, and I really wasn't. I worked as a subcontractor for him on this book project, and he photographed a friend of mine the following summer as a favor. I mean, I gave him $75, but that was kind of a joke in itself. That was just, I just covered, you know, his gasoline, I guess, because there was an energy crisis at that point still. But I never really worked for him or with him. I just worked, while I was doing the copy work for him, I did bring him my own work. I brought numerous samples of his work, asked questions. So yeah, I did learn a great deal from him. I heard a lot of really good stories, met his family, you know, spent time at his home at restaurants like Casa Escobar in Santa Monica and at my apartment there and also the home where I lived in East Hollywood on Fountain and Harvard. So, it was over a period of, almost a year. But in the years after that, I did keep in touch with him. I always did want to work for him, you know, as an assistant on shoots and also retouching negatives and printing, because I had already achieved those skills when I met him.
Did you start interviewing him in a formal way?
No, and I never recorded them. I just wrote down in the form. I wrote letters to a friend of mine in New York who had introduced me to Harrell's work a year earlier. I would, you know, write letters after I met, let's say, George Polsey, the cinematographer, or someone like that. I would write letters pretty much transcribing what I'd heard. So I have copies of all those letters, and those form the basis of the quotes in this book and my earlier Harrell book. And I also kept a log of what I would do day in, day out. So I was able to verify all these dates and places and everything. Because, you know, when you do a book like this, as I'm sure you know, with your Wellman book, you want to be as precise as possible about dates, places, times, what people said, didn't say, because there's been so much fudging going on in book, film histories, and it really irks me to see people saying, "Oh, so and so, I procured sex with so and so," and I mean, okay. Where are your telephone bills for that month? Where's your diaries? Where's the receipts? I mean, yeah, granted, that person like that wouldn't be keeping those kind of things for that purpose, but there are ways to verify facts. And unfortunately, many people who say, "Oh, I did these great interviews with people and they admitted that they were gay." Yeah, where are the tapes? But I do have a lot of tapes. I don't have a tape of him. Yeah, but I did a lot of interviews for this book, George Harrell's Hollywood, which came out last week from Running Press. And then my first Harrell book came out in 1997 from Abrams, Harry and Abrams. Yeah. And that was their best-selling film book. It went through 7 printings. Wow. Yeah, we're quite proud of that. But that book, I've always wanted to tell the full story of his life. And so this book has really given me the chance to tell the complete biography, to fill in a lot of facts, to correct little errors that were in the first book, and also in this case to have a huge number of photos, you know, printed in 4-color printing, which is pretty spectacular.
How many people did you interview for the book that knew him or had worked with him?
Oh, all of them. Yeah, I mean, that was a prerequisite. For example, the movie director Paul Morrissey, you know, known for Interview Magazine and Andy Warhol's Frankenstein, Andy Warhol's Dracula. He gave tremendous amount of information from him because he really knew Harrell very well between, let's say, 75 and 78, because he was putting together a portfolio marketing program, a gallery venture. And so he had great stories and great quotes and correspondence and records, all kinds of fantastic stuff. So I'm just so proud of this book. It's, you know, you want a book to be scholastically unimpeachable, but entertaining too. And the dirt that's in this book is definitely entertaining, thanks to Paul Morrissey and people like that.
Well, the thing about this book is it's not only entertaining and solid historically, but it's just also beautiful. And it's you can just lose yourself in these portraits. And wanted to talk a little bit just about the printing process of it, because we were talking earlier before the mics went on about how you did use Photoshop in some cases to bring out things that maybe had gone from the original preprint that you had.
Well, the story is that, let's say back in the 70s and 80s when I started printing for Harrell and other people, I would, you know, get the original camera negative, the negative that was shot on July something, 1934, at Sunset Boulevard in his studio. And I would, you know, put it into an 8x10 enlarger and project it onto photo paper, put that photo paper into chemicals, into developer, and then stop bath and then fixer, wash it for 20 minutes because I used the permawash, and then dry it on a drum dryer. So you'd have a print that looked very, very much like a print made 40 years earlier, 50 years earlier. But the difference was this print had a little better tonal scale and also would last much, much longer than prints made in those days. Although, in truth, I have prints from 1934 that are still pure black and white, have shown no signs of fading or any kind of decomposition. And the reason for that is that they, when they were made, these are the handmade prints of the key sets, they really, you know, used fresh chemicals, washed in the proper amount of time, and, you know, did the right, what's called archival printing. They did a great job. So those prints are beautiful, but the prints that I did, I think, have just a little better tonal scale than the prints from those era. And then recently the Ilford paper has gotten so silver rich, it looks really beautiful. So I had a great number of prints like that to work from, both vintage prints and prints that I had made from, let's say, 76, 77, right up through 2009, 10, 11. And in the days of the 90s, when I was doing my books before, in early 2000s, you'd send a box of photos to a publisher, each one in a little plastic case with a little post-it note on it saying, okay, this is for page so-and-so, number, picture of so-and-so. Not anymore. Not anymore.
I lost a lot of stills that way.
Yeah, a lot of people lost a lot of stills that way. But nowadays, they want just scans. And you can send it, you know, by Dropbox, or you send it on, what I've been doing is sending it on flash drives.
Sure.
But that means that I have to take a photograph, whether I printed it or the MGM lab printed it, you know, 80 years ago. You've got to scan it. Okay, so that means you've got to have that skill. And then once you scan it, ooh, all these little things show up you don't want to show up. Little scratches and little nicks and little white dots, little black dots. And as I mentioned to you earlier, when Harrell in his later period was photographing Paul McCartney, Farrah Fawcett, he was retouching the 8x10 negatives, but, you know, he was in his 80s, and he just thought, well, if I diffuse this a little bit, who's going to know if I put that those extra hour of retouching onto this or not? Well, the scanner knows it. So what I had to do then was use Photoshop to clean things up and to smooth things out, to make it look as if it had been printed, or retouched, I should say, retouched in 1935 by that some great retoucher at the MGM lab, some person who did that for 8 hours a day, and then went home and had a heavy cocktail afterwards. But I guess the point is, every picture in this book looks as clean and pristine and creamy as every other picture.
It's really spectacularly beautiful stuff. How aware was Harrell of his legacy? Because I've met a lot of film directors and other people who were involved in films in the 20s and 30s, and a lot of them felt like, well, I did the best with what I could with the equipment, and they felt a little bit almost ashamed of what they had done in some ways. Or they just felt like that the time had passed and so forth. Did he feel that way, or was he proud of what he had done?
He felt that way. He felt kind of modest and unassuming about it in the 60s and 70s when no one knew what this stuff was. Nobody really cared about it. They were just considered throwaway glossies, just publicity material. But when John Cobale, the British journalist, made a concerted effort and really mounted a campaign to reposition this material as fine art, then Harrell started to realize, you know, that what he'd done had lasting value. I must say in his defense that he never photographed anybody without doing his absolute best to make them look good, to create a unique, fresh image, without putting all his energy into it. He never gave less than his all. He really had integrity as an artist. But the odd thing was, he always felt deep down that photography was second best to painting. And that was an inner conflict that, you know, manifested itself in various ways with anger and frustration and various kinds of problems. But he, and so this is all detailed in the book, what I experienced with him and various people, you know, he was temperamental, he was cantankerous, he was angry. But I will say he never made a portrait of somebody and walked into it saying, oh, this is old bag, what am I gonna do? I'll just, he, you know, whether it was Luella Parsons, who was an old bag, or, you know, Shannon Tweed, who was a young, you know, actress in 1980 or 83 for Playboy magazine, he never gave less than his all, and you can see it. I mean, the work has a great artistic integrity.
We were talking a little bit earlier, and I think this is something that's I've thought about for many years, is that we look at the 20s, 30s, and 40s as being kind of the glamorous age of Hollywood, and I contend that the stills have more to do with that than the movies themselves, especially the work of Harrell, Clarence Bull, these guys who really knew how to work with lighting and with mood and also with drama, because I think Harrell would have been a great movie director if he had chosen to, because there's so much dramatic content in these photographs. Cinematography in movies, obviously there were glamorous close-ups and great lighting and all that, but it really seems that the photographs themselves are what cement this period as being a glamorous age.
Right, because the job of these photographers, you know, and there was a department at each movie studio, each company had its publicity department, and then in that department there was the portrait gallery, and their job was to create images that would A, sell a movie, and B, sell a star, not necessarily in that order. The idea was, okay, there's something special about this person that makes you want to go to a theater and pay money to watch him or her. All right, so you have to capture that in a still photograph, you know, without the benefit of sound or motion, and you have to tell a story in that still photograph. What Harrell at one point said was, he says, I'm not trying to make myself sound important, he said, but part of my job was even to groom these people. They'd bring someone to a studio who may not have even signed a contract or who had just signed a contract. Okay, what are we going to do with this person? And a lot of it depended on how this photo session went and how that person, you know, what quality came across most forcefully in that photo session. Was it glamour? Was it grit? Was it, you know, a winsome quality? Was it a sexy quality? And he had to, you know, it was kind of like an acid test, which way they'd go, these people.
I always wonder how much forethought he put into, for instance, we see shots of people with animal heads or other very dramatic looks, and sometimes it's all done with lighting or with faraway gazes. When, say, Jean Harlow or Loretta Young or whoever came into his studio, do you think that he had plotted out a series of images that he wanted to try for?
Yeah, it would depend. Here's, for example, let's say they're working on a film and they get to the last day of the film and he knows that the next day that star is coming to his portrait gallery with the costumes and the wigs or with the hairstyles of that film, and they're going to spend an entire day shooting every look from that film. And within each look, you know, let's hear what it would go like this. They'll start with wide shots with some props and some, like a column or whatever from the set of the movie or chairs and things like that. They'll start with kind of like fashion shots. Then they're moving closer and closer for some more moody shots. Then finally they're into just the head and shoulders with one spotlight, very dramatic and glamorous, doing very emotional, moody shots. Okay, that's with one set of clothes and one hairstyle. Then they'll take a break, and for an hour and a half, the star goes into a new makeup, a new hairstyle, a different wardrobe. And this wardrobe probably is the white, fluffy thing. So they're doing light background, more high key, more cheerful, smiling, winsome kind of pictures, as opposed to the previous thing, which was a slinky nightclub gown. So they're doing more dramatic and kind of sexy pictures. So it's just, you know, this was determined in advance by what was needed. But let's say you asked me about the polar bear rug. Well, in Jean Harlow, that famous shot of Jean Harlow with the polar bear rug. That's in her living room. And he had to go there because Vanity Fair wanted a portrait of Jean Harlow for a certain issue. So this is October 34. The issue was going to be in spring of 35, or January 35, whatever it was. If the polar bear had not been there, he would have done something else. In fact, he had her against the mantle, and he had her in various poses. But the idea was that bear happened to be there, but he also had used a bear at MGM, I think, 4 years earlier with Edwina Booth, 3 years earlier. So he liked that bear, and once the bear appeared in Vanity Fair, everybody wanted that bear, so he had to buy a bear.
So in that case, working for Vanity Fair, he was just like any photographer for hire. They would said, we want Jean Harlow at home, and give us a variety of shots of her in various rooms and various attitudes and so forth.
Right. He said, for example, in that case, let's have you sitting, leaning on this bear, and he says, how are we going to light this? Oh, well, there's a fireplace there. Okay, he puts a light in the fireplace to make it look like the light is coming from the fireplace. That's called a motivated light in film work, you know, movie cinematography. But it in this case, it applied too. But for the most part, he didn't have a set. He would just have a blank wall of in his studio on Sunset Boulevard. It was sprayed stucco. It had little dimples on it. And he'd get that person right up against that wall and have that light skimming right over that cottage cheese surface and get some wonderful effects with that. Whether it's Mary Pickford or Tulu Bankhead or whomever, you know, that he was photographing, get these wonderful, just, he said, I could design with light. If there's nothing else, he said, I would just use those spotlights and create nimbuses on the wall, shadows on the forehead, little triangles on the cheekbone, the light shooting down the person's hair, the part of the person's hair, he'd have a light shooting down there. Because he had a light on a boom. He was a person who invented that.
Wow.
And the light was just float around over the person's head, and he'd get that composition with that light first, that hot light on top of the head, along the arms and shoulders, create a pattern, and then he'd fill in from the front with a lower light. And then, as opposed to most people who would just say, okay, key light first on the face, then the fill light to fill in the shadows, then the hair light, then the background. Now, Harrell, total iconoclast, did very different approach to it.
Did he have any people that he really preferred working with?
Yeah, definitely Joan Crawford. They did 33 sessions between 1930 and 1946. And he said that she worked so hard, she was always on, she just loved it. He liked also Betty Davis because she really could create a mood almost instantaneously, go from one expression, one kind of a mood, very somber, to all of a sudden to very happy, you know, within the space of changing film from one film holder to the next. Norma Shearer was his patron. She was the one that got him into MGM, and they did a lot of sessions together, and most of them were not for a film. They were just something that they wanted to do to create a new look, and he liked working with her because she really did project and concentrate and you know, put as much energy into it as she would have to playing a character. He did not like people, for example, like Maureen O'Sullivan or Robert Montgomery, who kind of, you know, they didn't really want to do it. They went along with it kind of grudgingly. They felt like it was maybe beneath them, or they weren't in the mood, or why should I come in and do this after I've been working on a set all day? But to his credit and to their credit, there's some dynamic images of those people. But it wasn't as much fun to work with them as it was, say, with Mae West, who would make jokes, or Jimmy Durante would make jokes. But Harrell was one for also really putting on a show. And that could have been also in the case of Montgomery or O'Sullivan. Who is this guy? I'm the actor here. You're not the actor. You're a craftsman. That's all you are. Don't try and do my job. Because he did really make a lot of jokes and jumped around and scratched himself like a monkey, and he really upset Garbo. Greta Garbo, after one session with him in the gallery and one kind of short session on a set, said, I'm never working with him again. And indeed, when it was time to do Grand Hotel, portraits of her and John Barrymore, which were, you know, pretty big deal in 1932, he could not do them. They hired an outside photographer named Fred Archer, who worked a lot with Cecil B. DeMille. And Fred Archer came in and did the shots of Garbo and Barrymore, which really weren't very good. But Garbo refused to work with Harrell again.
Did she just find that he was too controlling, or what was it?
Exactly. She had to go into a trance to do these things. When when Clarence Bull photographed her, or Ruth Harriet Louise, they just wouldn't talk. They would just roll the camera around, get the lighting, and then they kind of nod, and she'd know, okay, I'm ready. And they, you know, squeeze the bulb, and she would be counting the number of exposures. So when they brought the proofs to her, there are 296 here. Where are the other four?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like, I mean, she worked with her film directors in such close collaborations. It surprises me that she would have reacted to Harrell that way.
No, the film directors, for example, Clarence Brown said, I was often, or at sometimes, pushed behind a black, you know, those big black thing called flats that mm-hmm. they used to close off the sets from ambient light. Sometimes she said, I'm doing a very serious scene. I don't want anybody watching me. And so you just have William Daniels there and the operator, I think his name was Bill O'Brien, running the camera, and Clarence Brown is out behind a black flat. Yeah, she really, after a certain point, she was directing her own films.
Yeah.
And Betty Davis, too.
Well, I know Davis was very willful about that, and it was always a little surprising to me that Joan Crawford was not more like that, because she was such a dynamic personality, but she seems to love to have been directed, as opposed to Betty Davis, who didn't seem to like being told what to do.
Well, it was sort of like Joan Crawford wanted people to work with her because they liked working with her, and because she was loyal to them, and because she, you know, she was kind to them. I mean, she could be cranky too with wardrobe at times.
Sure.
But the main thing was that she knew that, as did Barbara Stanwyck, that her image depended on these people, and, you know, she had to meet them halfway. But the thing is, Crawford seemed to meet them more than halfway, whereas some of these stars would become cranky. Jeanette MacDonald, for example, wouldn't come in on Christmas Eve to do a photo session with John Engsted at one point, I guess, in the early 30s, and that stayed with him for many years, and he really hated her. The other thing, too, was that these movie stars were, what Ethel Barrymore said, overpaid factory hands. They didn't have freedom at all. They had to do what they were told to do when they were told to do it. So to get, you know, go to the portrait gallery, but it's Christmas Eve and going to a party. No, you go to the portrait gallery. So she took it out on the poor guy in the gallery.
Sure. Well, I can imagine there was a lot of that in a movie star's life of those days, all sorts of publicity-related things that, if it were me, I would think, don't I get any time to myself, or do I have to just keep doing this stuff?
Yeah, a friend of mine worked with Bruce Willis on Moonlighting, and then she was working with him later when he started having these big action film hits. And he said, I wasn't prepared for it. He said, you know, TV fame is different than movie fame. He said, I wasn't prepared for the absolute lack of privacy.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, this wasn't any less true in 1929 than it was in 1991.
Yeah, I can imagine. But I think the difference is, and partly due to guys like Harrell, that movie stars of that era were seen as something apart in a way. Whereas I think somebody who's on a TV show, for instance, we went to an event a few weeks ago for the TV show Big Bang Theory. And my wife and I watched that show and enjoy it. And when you meet the people in person, it's like you know them already, because you see them every week. They're these familiar things. But somebody, if I were to meet Gene Harlow in 1934, I think I would have been a little bit nonplussed by just, I mean, it would seem like...
Oh, people were definitely in awe of these, because the publicity in those days in the media built them up, created an image. Now it's they tear them down.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So,
but that's what these pictures are, these Harrell portraits. And just to tell the listener, as I'm doing this, you're sitting at a table across from me, and there's this entire wall of these incredible portraits that I just keep staring at throughout this whole interview. And it's because of those things that partly made them these otherworldly figures, because these are not portraits of your next-door neighbor. These are special people. I mean, everything about them in the photographs mean there's something else.
And why I call him the inventor of the glamour photography, or of that that idiom was that before he got there, even Clarence Bull and Ruth Harriet Louise, their portraits still looked like the Main Street portrait salon.
Sure.
But Harrell really did bring something like an energy to it, and a clarity and a forcefulness where he did iconize the people, made them into icons. Before that, they were, appealing movie stars, but the real glamour thing did start around 30 or 31. And he had to follow guidelines that were very strict. The people had to look, sexy, but also wholesome. But when I say guidelines, I'm talking about, how you present a person in a photograph. There can be no jowls, no saggy eyes. I mean, if you look at the negative of these people, an 8x10 negative from, say, from 1934 of Virginia Bruce, who was young. Mm-hmm. Every inch of that negative of her face, her neck, her arms, her wrists, her fingers, every inch of that negative, every square inch has retouching on it. And if you've seen occasionally some of these negatives without the retouching, it's kind of a jarring experience. And also you see press photos of the same people from that period, without makeup and without the lighting, the glamour lighting. They don't look like different people exactly, but they don't have that otherworldly quality.
Sure.
And, as I say, these guidelines and the rules that you had to follow to create a star were so strict that it's just, eventually it just became very hard to keep up with it. So by the 50s, they just started to say, oh, who cares, And that's when the glamour photography went out the window. One thing, there were two factors really. Life magazine and World War II. And the overriding thing that affects us all up to the present moment, technology.
Yeah.
Smaller and smaller cameras, faster and faster film. You don't need to hold still and assume an exotic pose to have your picture taken. You can just like snap, snap, any lighting. It may not look as nice, but Life magazine didn't care. They said, life in the raw is seldom mild. And then World War II, people saw things that changed them forever, and it no longer mattered if every pore in your face was perfectly, glistening and beautiful as every other pore, it just bumps and warts and that. Well, that's, I've been in a trench in Guadalcanal. I don't care about, somebody's eyelashes, how long they are. So,
well, it was a time after World War II where regular people were lionized. Even the factory workers and the people who worked behind the war effort and all that, it was like the regular Joe was the hero. And so to have these idealized angels, was not...
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
As fashionable,
That's true. And you see, for example, in the post-war, when David Selznick is grooming people like Guy Madison and Louis Jordan, Alida Valley, they're still trying to do the glamour thing with him, and it doesn't jive with the characters they're playing in the films. Usually, it doesn't. It's just too much.
Yeah.
Whereas Robert Mitchum, what you see is what you get, and he has a real down-to-earth quality, and you don't need to glamorize him because it would seem artificial.
Yeah. And I think people in general these days especially don't like to think that they are being fooled, or so they want to know the real stories about people's lives. They want to know all the dirt. They don't want to think that somebody is better than them. Whereas these, and especially, I think it's really worth noting that a lot of these great portraits, and of course I keep looking at these Harlow pictures behind you, which are spectacular, but this is also during the Depression, and it's also a time when people needed a little idealization. They needed something to aspire to and something to take them out of
the... Yeah, I mean, I didn't really deal with this in the book, but with World War I, countries fell, empires fell, and icons fell, and religion fell. People in the 1920s were iconoclastic for a very good reason. They just had been through a horrible thing, and a lot of their beliefs were shaken.
Yeah.
Starting with the Titanic, ending with the Romanovs, with children being murdered.
Yeah.
I mean, that's horrible. So in the 30s, then they had this bubble burst, and they really had a gritty time to get through. So they wanted to someone to look up to, some hero, someone to idealize. And interestingly enough, I didn't know when I wrote my first book about George Harrell, or when I knew him, that he'd been an altar boy and was about to go into the seminary, the theological seminary, to become a priest. And a flip of the coin, he went to the Chicago Artist Institute instead, because he got a scholarship. So he was a devout Catholic, and you can see in a portrait of Norma Shearer, if you've ever been an altar boy, you look up at these statues, and there's a spotlight above the statue, and the beautiful glass eye has reflection from below of candlelight. And you look at these pictures of Norma Shearer, it's almost looked like a St. Teresa of Avila or the Blessed Mother or somebody in one of those statues in a Catholic church, because those glistening eyes and that creamy light.
I'm looking at one right now.
Yes.
And it is exactly as you describe. Yeah, very creepy in a way.
Yeah, he really did transfer this iconography from the Catholic church to Hollywood culture making.
And it's interesting that they're glamorous and they're beautiful and they're sexy, but rarely are they very erotic in the sense that we would think now. I mean, they're still just Jean Harlow with her bare shoulders is an erotic image, but not overly so, not what some people would make of the same subjects these days.
Oh, yeah, there were community standards then, but there was also censorship, but for a time, that was quite lax. So up until the summer of 1934, he could get away with more than he could afterwards. Because they had a Motion Picture Advertising Council after that point. They had to approve every single picture.
Now, didn't he take nude photos of Mae West?
Yeah, and she took the plates. And also Anna Mae Wong took the film.
What was the story of that? Obviously, they came in and requested.
He didn't tell. No, I'm sorry. She didn't tell him ahead of time.
Oh,
I think Anna Mae Wong did, I'm sure.
Oh.
But Mae West didn't tell me at the time. And with Harlow, he just kind of had her slide the blouse lower and lower and lower during there was a session of Girl from Missouri. But Mae West, you know, planned it like everything else she did. Was very, very, you know, intelligently prepared. But Harlow was kind of spontaneous. And Anna Mae Wong, I'm not quite sure about that. But in no case was he able to keep the material. And it really didn't matter because he wasn't going to be able to use it anyway.
Sure. You know,
there's no way they were going to publish that. He didn't shoot a lot of nudes. He did shoot some in Laguna Beach and some later for ad executives in New York when he was working for J. Walter Thompson. But not a lot. Of course, he did in the 80s Shannon Tweed for Playboy and also Joan Collins. Excuse me, Joan Collins for Playboy.
I wouldn't think that that would be something that would particularly bother him, though. I mean, even...
Oh, no, because his work had such an erotic flavor to it already. But he did it with expressions and with the styling of the shot.
And also, if he thought so highly of painting above photography, then that's certainly a classical notion in painting to do nudes. And I would think that that would be meat and drink to him if...
Although his real interest in painting was landscapes and trees and still lifes.
Because
I saw them, in his home.
Was he a good painter?
Not particularly. That's the sad part of the story, was that...
We often love most what we can't do well, right?
Exactly. And yet he had this gift. I mean, his eye for composition, unerring. I mean, airtight compositions. You can even crop into them, and they're still composed right. But he just seemed, and also his use of light. He really did innovate that top light with the bounce light from below reflecting up. That he's solely responsible for that. Cecil Beaton copied him. Steichen copied him. George Heineken Huynh copied him. They all copied him.
Now, when you knew him and wanted to get tips from him and get instruction from him, was he forthcoming with his techniques?
Yes, he was.
I keep hitting this table, sorry. Was he forthcoming with his techniques?
Yes, he was. He answered every question very straightforwardly. When he didn't was when he felt he was being exploited by somebody like John Cobell, who wasn't exploiting. They were trying to help him, you know, come back to have a second career. And he did get the second career, but it came through after he bumped Cobell out of the picture. Mm. He came from Alan Rich, who was an art dealer who became a very well-known actor playing character roles. And Alan Rich used all his connections and his showbiz kind of salesmanship to create a big hoopla around the idea of selling still photographs the way you would sell, at that time, lithographs. And it really went over very well, and Harrell was a great interview subject. So they had a big momentum. So then Harrell began shooting again and did all these, you know, Paul McCartney, Diana Ross, Harrison Ford, Farrah Fawcett, did all these wonderful things from between 1979 or 80 up right until 92 when he fell ill with cancer. But his last subject was Sharon Stone, and it was just as accomplished as anything he had done earlier.
And that's a beautiful shot of her.
And he had fantastic energy.
And she wrote the foreword to your book.
Yes. And we didn't have to edit it. She's a good writer.
Yeah. it's interesting looking at your book. The book is so great in so many ways. But the last chapter is where you do see those more contemporary shots. That's fascinating stuff because he's adapting to the energy of those people. So they don't look exactly like these shots of Gable and Harlow and everything, but they're still given that Harrell look. And it's really interesting to look at those things.
What I found interesting, too, at that time was that he did a lot of musicians and singers and performers in music, whereas you didn't see him do a lot of that in the 30s and 40s. I mean, you don't see him doing band leaders or, let's say, you know, Bing Crosby or, I mean, so, but you have him doing Paul McCartney, Diana Ross, David Byrne of Talking Heads.
Do you suppose because musicians are the people who are still bigger than life? And
at that time they were, you're right.
Yeah,
yes, Frank.
The movie stars that, are not.
You're exactly right, Frank. At that time, movie stars had been democratized. But musicians in the 70s and the 80s, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, every album. Remember when those albums would come out at Tower Records, you'd have a line to buy a new album, and it would be sold out in an hour?
Well, even today, Diana Ross is not like us. You know,
that's true, yeah.
She is something else. And certainly Paul McCartney is way beyond
the
normal human in terms of our perception of
yeah, so it made sense for Harrell to be glamorizing them at that time.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the photography they were getting was substandard, I hate to say.
Well,
the album covers in the early 70s were just ugly. Well, you know, movie star photos at the time were ugly, too. I mean, they were really badly done. Now, I just wonder what Harrell would think of digital, if he would use Photoshop in the same way that he used pencil lead on retouching the emulsion on a negative.
I would think that he would be intrigued by it because people who really know how to use digital and you know how to use coloring and all that can get some spectacular results from it. So I would think as an artist, he would really respond to what the possibilities were.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he would.
Yeah, I think so too, yeah.
But I didn't know him. I want to talk about some of your other books. It's always seemed to me, because you wrote the first book on Harrell in the 90s?
97 it came out. And that it did very well.
Yeah.
And it really, and I like to think also that it, because I was seeing in Vanity Fair, other magazines, the cosmetics ads for the next couple few years after that, all of a sudden they seemed like they were trying to copy with digital the effects that he was getting with the pencil lead on the negative, making the skin so shiny and smooth. That was a very popular book.
But it seems like even other books kind of spring from your interest in that era. You did a great book on Irving Thalberg and the one on pre-code films and obviously pre-code stills.
The CineSoft Focus.
Yeah. And so is it just that as you researched Harrell and his world, you just became interested in the adjoining subjects?
It was the other way around. You know, if you're growing up in East Oakland in the 50s, you'd see these movies on TV in the afternoons and the early evenings because they'd all been dumped on TV at that point, making the studios richer than they already were. So you'd see these movies, and I would go to the Oakland Public Library and borrow books to learn about, you know, Thalberg. There was a book, The Lion's Share. And so, anyway, the point is I was interested in films and filmmaking, and this happened later. So when I write a book about, let's say, the horror films, I'm hearkening back to what I learned and studied, you know, through Famous Monsters of Filmland in the 60s and thereafter, you know, about horror films, but adding to it the, you know, the scholarly skills that I have now, thanks to people at USC Library like Ned Comstock and the Academy, you know. But I guess what I try to do in these books is to take a subject that, you know, that intrigues me, like the next book that's coming out is called Majestic Hollywood, the films of 1939, is to take a subject that's, let's face it, it's quite familiar. I try to bring a new aspect to it, I try to get as much of the sound and the feeling of that time using the actual voices of the people as possible. For example, the chapter on The Wizard of Oz, I found a wonderful thing. There was an art critic at the LA Times, took his family to see, to the Carthay Circle, to see The Wizard of Oz. On the way out, he and his wife and his two children and a neighbor child were interviewed. What did you think about The Wizard of Oz? And it is absolutely delightful.
Wow.
And the other thing, for example, would be people who would go onto the set of Gone with the Wind while it was shooting. These unpublished, I think there was Hedda Hopper and some other people. But the thing is, you're transported back in time. That's what I like to do with these books, whether it's Cine Soft Focus, where you have the fight between the producers and the censors, or Garbo, where you really see how did she actually work. I like to take you back in time, take you by the hand. Okay, you may not know who these people are or what these movies are, but I want to take you to a magical place and give you a unique experience.
Well, the Thalberg book is of particular interest to me because he's such a fascinating man himself, and he really kept the spotlight off of himself as much as he possibly could throughout his lifetime. So that must have been a real challenge to research that book.
Yeah, because there's so few, you know, actual things in print about him. But once you get into the archives and papers, and I got Norma Shearer's unpublished memoir notes, that made a big difference too, because there were, you know, about their honeymoon and things like that. But I guess what I hope to do with each book is to learn something myself, not just to bring you by the hand and say, here, look at this, isn't this great, but it's to say, look what I found. I didn't know about this. And all these years I thought I knew everything about Irving Thalberg. And in that case, for example, what I learned was he was really laid low by the critical indifference to Romeo and Juliet. The film was doing well when it first came out. It wasn't a flop. I mean, yeah. The problem was he fell into the trap that he had criticized Eric von Stroheim for, spending too much money on things that wouldn't show on the screen.
Yeah.
So it's ironic. So I learned that about him. He was, and that contributed to his death.
Wow.
He was so depressed. Yeah. He was terribly depressed. And it was doing well, but the critics were nasty about it. Not about her. They didn't say she was a bad actress. They just said he was foolish for making the movie. They said she did well in spite of that. Nobody criticized her acting. Norma Shearer's acting. It was that why are you doing this? This belongs on stage, not on the screen.
Wow. So, yeah, it's a. How many people did you talk with who actually had worked with him?
Sam Marks, Chet Schaefer, Harrell. Let me think, who else? Probably fewer than 10, but they were good ones. I mean, people who had important positions. And then of course there were all these amazing documents at the Columbia University, at the Academy, USC. I mean, I found a lot of primary reference material, things that had never been published before.
Yeah. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. It's really fascinating to look at all of the films that he made through the prism of Thalberg as the auteur, for lack of a better term, because I think in many ways he really was. I mean, he shaped those films.
Yeah, because I mean, I was in college that this auteur theory was a big deal in the early 70s, and yet you would never see it applied to Irving Thalberg or Cecil B. DeMille or David Selznick, and who were, you know, more more properly authors of their own work than those three artists.
Yeah, who in the world would seriously say that Victor Fleming directed Gone with the Wind, or that he was the guy behind Gone with the Wind? He did direct maybe even most of it.
But
Selznick was the guy who made that film.
And you know,
and it's Selznick in every frame.
Oh, yeah, and Wizard of Oz is a Mervyn LeRoy film.
Absolutely.
I mean, Fleming had, you know, was able to bring all those wonderful touches to it and really to get those people, you know, up to speed. But LeRoy, you know, he loved that book as a child.
And King Vidor was on it, too.
And LeRoy wanted it to be the book he read as a child.
Well, that's one of the things, too, just about the auteur theory, which I came, it was happening when I was very young and starting to think about film. So I sort of came into it as though it were a fact, and then spent the next decades realizing that it's not a fact at all. But working on this new Wellman book, that we're literally putting in chronology his entire career. So it'll be a film that he directed, and then we'll talk about a film that he started and then stopped, or a film that he went on, such as China Seas.
Right.
He directed most of it.
Yeah.
Female, he directed virtually the entire picture.
See, I didn't know that.
And it's still...
I love that film.
Yeah, it's still not credited.
I had no idea.
But what you really come to find out as you research all these things and go through Daily Variety and who's coming and who's going and all that stuff, or Weekly Variety at that time, is that almost all of these films had multiple directors. Almost all of them, and especially at a place like MGM, they were just, you know, somebody would be gone for a few days and somebody else would come in and work for a few days and then they'd go and then somebody else would come in. And you look at a film, I think Tarzan Escapes might be the top. I think there are 9 directors on that, maybe.
That sounds right.
So the idea that whoever's name ended up on the credit card on the film was the auteur of that film is ridiculous. He happened to win the lottery of whose name got on it, but it's...
And they were never in the editing room.
No.
No, that was the producer.
Yeah.
You know, Hunt Stromberg was an auteur.
I saw this article one time in Film Comment magazine, and I love Film Comment, but in this case, they dropped the ball. It was an article about George Sidney, and the writer was discussing the credit sequence of, the Harvey Girls. And the writer says, you know, there's a picture of a train and a frame, and in this way, Sidney is signaling that it's a nostalgic piece looking back at the blah, blah, blah. And I thought, does this writer really think that George Sidney had anything to do with the credit sequence of that film at all?
Any more than the famous credit sequence in Maytime with all the blossoms forming the letters on the...
Yeah.
I mean, that was Hans Stromberg.
Yeah. You get somebody it's so funny. But it's,
Because, you know, it's very consistent when you watch the films of a certain, like over a period of 15 years in that period, you see certain producers liked very elaborate title sequences and other producers said, oh, the hell with it, just put white letters on a black background.
And sometimes the title sequence is so a part of the feeling of the film that you just feel like, oh, it all came from the same place.
Well, like The Rains came with the letters, the rain is washing away the letters.
Yeah.
And I think, see, in that case, when you have Clarence Brown going to 20th, he said that they were very easy to work with that compared to MGM, different departments. So in that case, I'd say he was responsible for that, but... you know, in most cases, it was a particular supervisor, producer.
Sure.
Yeah,
the Lady Eve, when you have the animated snake crawling through the credits and everything, it just seems like it seems so much in the spirit of that film that, oh, Preston Sturges must have done that. But I'm sure Preston Sturges had nothing to do with that.
Yeah. So. I think the one exception would be Joseph von Sternberg between 30 and 35. I mean, everything, every frame, every sound.
Well, there were those guys. I think Albert Hitchcock is one.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Who really controlled virtually everything in his films. But by and large, at least the people from the era that I most am interested in researching, Wellman, Hawks, Walsh, Ford,
They all have distinctive elements to their direction and things that I can name from film to film that seem distinctively theirs. But they still worked with the studios and they still did what the producers wanted them to in most cases.
Well, because for one reason, there wasn't time to do that. I mean, any more than Harrell could retouch his own negatives after a certain point. Not to mention that the retouchers were better retouchers than he was.
Yeah. I envy those days in a way, because when you think of a director, you know, finishing up his film, he comes into the office, there's a script on his desk, here's your new picture. It just seems so simple. It seems so simple in a way.
And they had such great people to work with. I mean, the craftspeople, who were just, you know, every department had the best.
Yeah, that's the real tragedy of the death of the studio system, is that all that stuff was in place, and you could really count on the quality of what you were going to get from those people. And in most cases, it was a costume designer or a prop man or whoever that you'd worked with on 10 other films.
Right.
So it was all interesting stuff. Did Harrell ever think about making films himself? Did he have any interest in that?
There was one. Joan Crawford wanted him to direct some scenes, and he was temperamentally unsuited to it because it just took so long to light an entire set that combustive, spontaneous quality he had was just it. He was totally impatient and was cranky and yelling, and it lasted a few days.
Oh,
yeah.
What was the film?
I don't know. Ted Allen told me, and he didn't know what film it was.
How interesting.
But mid-30s.
Yeah. As I said earlier, you look at these pictures and there's such a dramatic quality to them that you really do have the feeling that he could have just stepped sideways into the that. Because there's something about these that is not present in the photography of anybody else.
And he also was able to direct the people, you know, to communicate with them the way that a director would.
Yeah. But, I don't know, we should head off pretty soon. I will put a link to your book on the webpage, and indeed we'll have links to all of your books.
Oh, thank you, webpage.
But, boy, I really want to recommend your latest. And I assume it's widely available everywhere, and the only trouble is you're going to have a friend with you to help carry it to the car.
I haven't weighed it yet, but it's quite heavy.
It is. It's enormous, but is it beautiful.
It's very gratifying at this time in the history of our culture to see a company like Running Press and an editor like Cindy De La Hose really show the confidence in this product that it needs to say, we're going to give this four color printing. We're going to give you this number of pages. They did not give me short shrift in any way, shape, or form. Another company was interested in doing it before this, and they said, we don't want too much Joan Crawford in it, and there's not going to be any text, and let's skip the captions too, and we don't want to have any 70s or 80s people in here that need another later work. And I thought, well, you know, what's the point of doing it then?
Sure. I've become so disheartened by the state of the film book these days, especially when it comes to illustrations. And because nobody wants to put the money into printing the photographs properly. And so it's so gratifying to look at something like this. And you have my total envy for this thing, too, because it's just, they did it right. They did it as right as you can do it, I think. And so these are as close. And as a matter of fact, I bet in some cases they look better in this book than they looked in the original magazines or wherever they first.
Oh, and there's no question.
Other than seeing the print directly from the negative, this is as good as it gets with these.
Well, things. I hate to tell you, there are some cases where the print in the book looks better than the print that it came. I was able to enhance it with the highlight shadow tool in Photoshop.
Yeah.
Put some tones back in there that had faded away. So, yeah, this is, and, you know, I have to say I'm really pleased because there's been so much misinformation about Harrell, but also so many bad reproductions of his work, that this book really sets the record straight.
Yeah, it really does. And I recommend it as highly as I can recommend anything. And it's also just a solid piece of film history work. I mean, it's beautifully written, but it's also researched to a fare thee well.
Well, because I was there. I knew him, and there's a lot of, I mean, some of it, I think, is unpleasant. Some of it's unflattering. But I'm happy to say that, you know, that there's a happy ending to the book. The story, the conflicts in his life and his personality were resolved. But a lot of this stuff, people are going to say, wow, that's that was a scandal that almost happened, or that in some cases it was a scandal that did happen.
Yeah.
Why he had to leave Hollywood at the peak of his career and couldn't come back for many years. So that's all in there, and it's, you know, told honestly. It's all documented, you know, from letters, documents, and my own diaries. So it's all there for the people to enjoy after they finish, you know, enjoying the photos.
Yeah, I have many what you might call coffee table books at home that once you've gone through them and looked at the pictures, that's all there is to it. But this is a genuine book.
This is a full-scale biography, yeah. 100,000 words, and it's from his birth to his death and everything in between.
Well, I wish you nothing but great luck with it, and we have so many other things to talk about that one of these podcasts is not going to be enough. So let's do another Sunday.
Let's do the Beaugest part of the next book.
I'm ready. Now, when is that book coming out?
December 10th. It's to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the films of 1939. It's called Majestic Hollywood from Running Press, and it's come out, you know, in time for the entire year of 2014, which is, of course, the anniversary of that year. But this book has all the films that took, you know, Jesse James and The Rains Came and all those beautiful films, beautifully illustrated. And I've gotten, as I say, fresh stories to share.
Great. Except that it should have been called Beaugest and Others. But other than that, I'll give you whatever. So thanks very much, Mark. This has been great fun for me.
Thank you, Frank.
I sure hope you enjoyed that conversation with Mark Vieira. I'm going to have him back one of these days because with a career like his and the books that he's written, we got lots more to talk about. So we'll do that one of these days. I want to once again urge everybody to help support this podcast. We have people who really love the show and people who support it avidly, but there just aren't enough of them. So please spread the word. Please go to iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating. Just tell people, tell everybody that you know who's interested in movies to listen to this. I think that once they get started, they'll want to hear more, and then we can just build our audience. The iTunes thing is really important, and I'm finally up to 52 reviews, which after a year and a half is, you know, it's better than 42 reviews, but it could be a lot more. And the commentary track has a Facebook page, which is pitifully low on likes. And so I urge you to go there. It's very easy to find. And just hit like. And again, share the page. Send it around. Please let people know about this, because we need to build up a listenership far beyond what we currently have. And I know that once people listen to the dulcet tones of my beautiful wife, Claire McCullough, as my announcer, and when they see the websites designed by the great James Hutchins, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv, and when they hear the beautiful theme music by Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand, they're going to be hooked. Come on, how could they not be? They're going to be hooked. So please, help me out. Doesn't cost you a penny, although I would be remiss if I did not say that there is a donate button on the front page of the Commentary Track website, and I sometimes get some donations, and I am incredibly grateful for those when they come, and it would be great if I got some about, you know, 40 times a day, or I'd settle for 20 times a day. Come on, I'm not greedy, I just want to get by. So I urge you to spread the word and support the podcast, even if you don't support it monetarily. Just support it with word of mouth and support it with saying good things about it. And, you know, just general good vibes. So we've got another great guest for you coming up next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.